Hello and welcome to Mohawks Meet the Team series, a podcast dedicated to the team behind creating the strategy title, Old World. We'll get to know more about the team and their work on the project. This week, we're joined by Soren Johnson, the design director of Mohawk Games, and we learn about his serendipitous college roommate and a lot more, so stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the show, Soren.
Hey, Rob. How's it going?
It's going well. This is the second time we've spoken, first on an interview, and I've kind of gotten to know you in the real world too, which is kind of cool. But I think I'm here to talk to you about some of the stuff that's been going on in your life before all this, before we've gotten to this point. And so I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, where should I start?
Let's go with the second day after you were born. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Washington State, a little town called Centralia, Washington, which is kind of a little rural town, but it's not too far from Seattle. So I had experience with, a big city, but I grew up in a little town, type of town where you have like kind of one high school and you kind of know, a lot, not small enough where it's like, a couple families, but generally speaking, most of the people in town have some connection with each other. No moving around, just was there until I graduated. And as you could probably imagine, I was into video games, but not just video games. I was into music. I played a lot of soccer. I was a bright kid who liked school, got into, history and, English and, science and things like that.
I had no idea you were a soccer player. How long did you play soccer?
Just grew up playing with it, So with music, I played the cello, and with soccer, that's something, those are both essentially decisions my parents made for me, right? When I was 6 or 7 or whatever, just started to do it. And, it's always interesting, when that moment is that you stop doing something because you're supposed to, and you start doing it because you want to. And with soccer, I don't remember exactly when that happened as much, but, soccer was pretty fun. So it was nice to actually, I'm not super coordinated or athletic, but it was nice to have a sport that I played long enough that I actually got pretty good at it. With soccer, with the cello, there's a pretty good story in that probably around 8th or 9th grade, I was going into for one of the school concerts, and I was running a little quickly, and I tripped. And I kind of fell over, and I put my knee right through the back. It fell right forward. Basically, I was holding my cello running. I fell right on top of it. My knee went right through the back of it and basically destroyed my cello. And, it was, the type of thing probably, my parents probably got a little upset. Something I understand a little bit better now that I'm a parent. And, they had probably gone through many years of basically forcing me to play each day. And, so they I could tell they had that kind of moment as a parent where they were like, all right, well, he doesn't, he fought playing the cello. He just destroyed his cello. I guess we can say he can call it quits. So they're like, okay, well, you don't have to play anymore. I'm like, what do you mean? I don't want to stop. Right. And so, sure enough, we bought another cello, and, I think it kind of like made me realize that it was actually something that had been an important part of my life. And, and I played through college, and now I just play occasionally, although Layla and I have sometimes worked on some duets together. Which is kind of fun. She plays the piano.
Yeah, I think I've seen videos of you guys doing that, right?
I'm not sure if we've released anything.
Sorry. That was just something that I found. I hacked into your...
Right. Hidden on our phone somewhere, probably. But it's something that... It's the type of thing I wish I could do more, but maybe someday.
Very cool. So what brought you to the DC metro area?
Well, that kind of... It's going to thread through my whole life to get to that point. I came out here in the first place because I grew up on the West Coast, went to school in California for college, and I never really planned to basically leave the West Coast because I love the West Coast. It's very nice out there. But when I started looking for jobs after college, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do going through school, but I was a computer science history double major and eventually get a master's in computer science. It's kind of these things where in retrospect, it should be obvious that I would get into video game development. But the problem is that back in the mid 90s, and for some reason, when I got to high school, I kind of actually stopped playing video games for a while just because there was just so much other things going on. Just all of the excitement of high school and, started to date, and also actually I was really into making movies during that period also. Kind of took up most of my time. And so I kind of dropped out of video games for a while, but it was a huge part of my life growing up in the 80s. And going into college, it wasn't necessarily clear that it's not like nowadays where there's all these huge video game developers and it's a very, you know, there's video game programs like at universities and it's kind of clear that like this is okay, an actual profession. That had started to happen a little in the 90s, I think, as you had companies like, you know, id and BioWare and just in general companies like, you know, Activision and EA start to, you know, get bigger and bigger, but I hadn't necessarily noticed. And so instead I was kind of like thrashing around, just kind of figuring out what I was going to do. I went to Stanford and this was in the mid 90s. So like I have friends who were some of like early employees at Google and many other startups at the time. So like that would have been kind of the more natural path for me because this was really like the birth of the internet. And there was just a ton of activity in that area at the time. But for whatever reason, I wasn't particularly interested in making stuff that was just, you know, just a, like had a commercial bent. Like the purpose of it was, you know, like making a business, right? What I was really interested is in history and like how can we use computers to do something new with history, right? Like I wanted to, for instance, I got to spend a quarter overseas at Oxford my junior year. And I spent most of that time in the, well, not most of the time, but I spent a lot of time there in the archives, the Oxfordshire archives, researching the lives of shopkeepers in the early modern period, which means like 1700s, 1600s, like what their guilds was like and what they sold and, you know, like how much money they made and like what their families were like. And I took all the information back the next year and I made this, you know, through the history program, you know, there's some sort of big project you put together at the end and it's always going to be a paper, right? You're writing this thesis paper. You know, I just was like, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to make a simulation of it. I want to make essentially a game of what it was like to live the life of a shopkeeper in 1700s Oxford, right? And I don't know necessarily why I wanted to do it that way. I think I have a certain contrarian bent to me where, you know, I just want to try to do, I want to do something differently. I want to do something that other people aren't doing. And it also just felt like, okay, I have this ability. Like I don't really love to program, but it's just always come easy to me. And so it's like, I can put these two things together. You know, why don't I? So, you know, that's what I did. And, you know, it was pretty cool. Like my professor was really impressed. They really liked it, but there wasn't really like a path to making like historical simulations in the academic world, right? And in many ways, the more obvious path was just to like get into video games. And I was also lucky in that I had a friend at school named Jim Brooks, who had done an internship at Electronic Arts, like his maybe his junior summer after his junior maybe or something. And he, you know, I saw that he was doing that, and you know, we talked. And he was like, "Yeah, I can probably get you an interview there." And so one of the summers, I guess probably the summer after my first year of being a master's student, I got to do an internship at Electronic Arts working on Knockout Kings, which is a boxing game for the original PlayStation. And I didn't know much about boxing, didn't know much about the PlayStation. I don't think I've ever actually even owned a PlayStation. You know, got me into the industry. And back at that time, basically, like if you could get that first job, you know, if you get that first job, then suddenly you were in, like you could turn it into a real career. And, you know, really enjoyed it. They wanted me to stay on, but, you know, I was looking for a full-time job. And actually what I really wanted to do was, you know, I graduated in like December of 1999. And, you know, kind of like I for whatever reason, I ended up graduating in the middle of the year. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to do the thing that they kind of do in Europe where you take a gap year and you just kind of like, although I guess they do that usually before college, but I'm going to take some time off. I'm going to go travel to South America. I'm going to take this big 2-week road trip with one of my best friends, a guy named Bill, where we're going to see, we were going to go to like every baseball stadium in the, on the, essentially the eastern half of the US. And we saw like 17 baseball games in 14 days. It was really crazy. And, you know, I was going to do all these things. And I was like, because I know that like, once I get into the video game industry, like I'm going to be, you know, I mean, it's going to be really intense. But right when I was graduating, which would have been about November or December of 99, the news broke that Brian Reynolds was leaving for Axis. And he was the guy who designed Civilization II and Colonization and Alpha Centauri. And he had left MicroProse with Sid Meier to form Firaxis. And he had made Alpha Centauri there, which was a really great game. And, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know why he had left. It seemed kind of actually unusual because he had founded a company. But, you know, later on, I met everyone and I kind of learned more about what happened. But, you know, from my perspective, suddenly, you know, I had been kind of following Firaxis because, you know, I really love Sid's games and seemed like the type of company I'd be interested in joining. Then I saw that Brian left. And then later, you know, like a month or two later, the news kept coming out. They're like, oh, and Jason Coleman left and Tim Train left. And, you know, all these very David Inscore left, all these other people who were like senior people at Firaxis were all leaving to join Brian's new company. And they were supposed to be. And the other reason I was following Firaxis is that Civilization 3 had been announced. Civ 1 was a game that I bought, like, I think literally my first week of college. Like, it was almost like my return to video games. I had kind of not played anything for a long time. And, you know, I was at the Stanford bookstore and there in the, you know, somewhere tucked away. I don't know. It's really interesting. Now that I look back, that it's even there, was even there. But, you know, somewhere in that bookstore, they had a small video game section. And of course, they had Civilization. And it was kind of one of those games you just saw because I played a lot of Pirates, played a lot of Rogue Tycoon, games that I loved. And when you saw Sid working on a game, you know, a game about Civilization, somehow it just made sense. It wasn't even surprising to me. It was just like, well, that's kind of like the obvious next step. And got the game, loved it, of course. And, you know, later when I saw them, they were making Civ 3, I was like, well, that sounds like a pretty cool project. And then I started hearing that basically the members of the team who were well enough that you would know who they are through like the company's website had all left. And so, you know, I thought to myself, like, this seems like a really, really good opportunity. And because not only would I be, you know, potentially be able to work on Civ 3, but like, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm probably going to be in a position where there's not going to be a bunch of people above me, so to speak, right? Like, they're probably going to need me to contribute at a high level right away. You know, it was kind of, in a sense, it felt like it was a way to kind of like skip ahead of like the dues paying part of my career. And, you know, I applied there. They flew me out, did the interview, met Sid, pressed them enough to, you know, get the job. And by the way, apparently, as sort of a side note, as I mentioned earlier, they told me later that the reason they picked me to an interview from all the resumes they got is they like the fact that I played the cello. So, you know, I don't know. Oh, Firaxis, yeah, it's kind of bizarre. Firaxis is a very musically inclined studio, or at least was back then. I mean, now it's like a 200 person studio, and, you know, I'm sure it has its own culture now. But back then, it kind of like half the studio all played instruments. And of course, Sid made this kind of unusual product called CPU Bach, you know, where he was like generating Bach music from scratch, you know, and so it was just kind of part of their DNA. And so it made a certain amount of sense, but at any rate, so I, you know, they got offered me the job, and I guess, and this is all like, I'm not doing this in a very natural way, but like, I was going to like not start working until the next September. And at this point it's January or February. I was like, I'm going to take 6 or 7 months off. I've worked really hard in college. I need this time. And basically this opportunity happened. And I was like, every other studio I interviewed at, I'd said like, okay, I'd love to come work here, but I can't start till September. And I know some really good ones turned me down because of that. Like, I'm pretty sure that's what happened for both BioWare and Ensemble. Like, they both were interested, but they, you know, when I said September, they were like, okay, sorry, we can't, that's just too far away. But this was just something where I was like, I just can't pass this up, right? Like, I love history. I love Sid's games. The team is they need me to, you know, like, they didn't tell me this is going to be for a design role, but knowing the way that Sid works and the fact that like there was just nobody left, there was like one programmer left, like they basically had one programmer left who was the intern on the previous project, like that was all they had. And so you know, it just seemed like an opportunity I couldn't pass up. So that's how I ended up in Baltimore, because that's one of the few ways I would have ended up out here. Otherwise, you know, it seems like very unlikely I would decide to move out here. For the most part, have been in this area, you know, ever since.
So an opportunity you just couldn't possibly pass up, and all right, presented to you and made possible by your parents because they forced you to play the cello. That's awesome.
Yep. That's sort of how it all. It's one of these things where like this is the narrative and how it actually happened, but it doesn't really make sense.
Right. It's some of those weird butterfly effect things, right? Like, you start the cello when you're young and you have no idea that that's going to be the gateway into something as big as Firaxis, and then right, you know, that's many more things. So what was your responsibility at Firaxis when you got there?
So they put me just, I mean, starting off, just they had to like, it was a pretty crazy project because there was like no one there. What it was is just the Alpha Centauri code base with some like Civ 2 art pasted on top of it. So there had been very little work done because the people who were supposed to be working on Civ 3 were basically working on leaving the company to form Big Huge Games to make Rise of Nations. And so it was pretty challenging because we had this big code base that nobody understood. And I'm sure it made sense to the people who wrote it, but to us, you know, it involved a lot of macros we didn't understand, just a lot of stuff that you could tell they had built a system, and we had to kind of decide, okay, are we going to try to learn the system, or are we going to try to like, you know, kind of rebuild this thing from scratch? And after kind of like a couple months banging our heads against it, we kind of decided, or maybe I even should just say I decided that we were going to jettison it. So I went through a couple like benders essentially of just ripping out all the old code, where, you know, I just spent a week trying to delete as much code as I possibly could so that you could get everything down to a place where it was understandable enough that you could rebuild Civ on top of it. So that was my first job. And then eventually I moved on to working on AI. And the guy who ran the company with Sid was a guy named Jeff Briggs, and he was the kind of the original lead designer. And so he had set down a lot of the, you know, some sort of the basic ideas of what Civ 3 should be, you know, like, so he had kind of like a general guidance that there should be something about resources, right? And there should be something about culture, but he kind of like needed someone to figure out how to make that happen, right? So, you know, so I was the one who kind of decided, okay, we'll put iron and horses around the map, and you'll have to hook them up to your cities with roads, and you can't build, you know, chariots unless you have horses. And like with culture, it's like, okay, you have various, you know, some of the buildings will produce culture and it'll fill a box. I think they kind of like advised me that, you know, Civ players, what they really love is to see buckets fill up with stuff, right? So, you know, kind of did that, figured that out, how to get that to work with culture. And it was one of these things where eventually, like everything clicked in that I was like, oh, I know, culture should determine your borders. It wasn't that way initially. You know, it took a long time to kind of get there, and that it should keep. Well, actually, you know what? I think I got that fairly early because I wanted the border systems from Alpha Centauri. That's kind of like when you go back to Civ 2, that's one of the big things that stands out to you, where you're like, oh, wow, there's no borders. The AI can just come and sit next to my cities if they want to, right? So I knew, you know, I knew we wanted borders, and I kind of like, okay, this is like chocolate and peanut butter. We'll set culture and borders together. But for a long time, the borders weren't necessarily that impactful, right? Like you'd have the situation where you founded your first city, you get those initial 8 extra tiles, and you could, but your cities could still work tiles outside of your borders. And at some point I was like, okay, we have to make the borders matter. I'm going to make the rule that you can only work tiles if they're inside your borders. And there was like some resistance to that initially, where people were like, oh, no, can't do that. That's crazy, you know? and you know, but one of these things that once you try, it seems obvious in retrospect, because it's even almost more confusing the other way. You know, so it was a long process of doing this type of stuff, you know, figuring out what were going to be the major big changes to Civ 3 and how to make it work. Yeah, I'm proud of like a lot of the things that worked out well in Civ 3. I also say the bargaining table, I don't think there was another strategy game that had done anything like that before, where, you know, you kind of like, you meet with Gandhi or whatever, and you offer him like, I'll give you some saltpeter, and I'll give you some incense if you'll give me, you know, like 50 gold a turn and something else. And like, you know, there is like this back and forth of like, you, these are all the things you can put on your side of the table, and these are all a bunch of things they can put on their side. I mean, that's kind of a staple of the, you know, genre now. You'll see it, you know, basically everywhere. And it'll be interesting, at some point we can circle back to this, because there's a lot of stuff in Old World which is actually a rejection of ideas that I came up with for Civ 3. Like, I actually now think that the bargaining table, I wouldn't say it's a bad idea, because, you know, I'm glad that it was in Civ 3, and I think it's still kind of a useful idea. But I think it's been, generally speaking, it's been bad for the genre, because it makes, you know, makes diplomacy too transactional. And the real problem is you can just spend forever fiddling with what's on both sides of the table, right? It's not particularly interesting. So at any rate, but this was literally my first job out of college, so that was the best I could do at the time.
I'd say that's a pretty good start. And yeah, to your point about the bargaining table, I feel like
you know, it's become a point where there's just so many games that implement that diplomatic mechanic, and it ends up being an easy way to cheese the AI, right? And
yeah,
I feel like that's kind of taken away from what would probably be a fun, as it started, probably a fun mini game within diplomacy. But so circling back around to something, because someone asked me about Soren Johnson, I kind of equate you with being both someone who's very good at AI and very good at design. How do those two coincide? Why is it that you're so well known for your AI work?
Yeah, well, so to me, AI is kind of like an extension of game design. That, you know, I think it's probably helped that I've always kind of viewed the same things as, you know, kind of equivalent. I don't really look at it as there's the designers over here and then there's the AI programmers over there. And I think actually a lot of teams are built that way, where, you know, the designers design the rules and then the AI programmers kind of like deal with whatever they get, and they just have to like do the best they can. The way you might see, say, a digital board game get made, right? Where, you know, designed through the ages, you know, a long time ago, you know, he just designed it however he wanted to, right? And then 10 years later in the future, some programmer was tasked with trying to write the AI for it, right? And by the way, there's a wonderful digital version of that game. So like they've done a fantastic job with it. Basically, the point is that the AI programmers don't have any input into the design of the game, right? Like they're just stuck with it, right? The most, you know, extreme version of this would be, right, you know, like chess, right? So, you know, the rules are what they are, and the AI programmer has to come up with the best they can, you know. And sometimes that means that there can be rules that are really challenging for the AI. And to me, I always looked at the two things needed to be developed in parallel, that when you design rules for the game, you also have to think about what the AI can handle. And so, you know, I did the design for Civ 3 and Civ 4, and I also wrote the AI for Civ 3 and Civ 4. And that, you know, like there, you know, I was doing them at the same time, although I actually was, that's actually the reason we made Civ 4 multiplayer right off the bat, is that it allowed us actually to do a lot of the design really early without needing any AI, just to get a basic sense of how things were feeling. But for sure, like, I added a lot of rules, and there were certain things I just decided not to do, because it was like, you know, I don't think the AI can handle this, so I'm not going to put it, you know, I'm not going to put it in the game. And since then, I know that that's kind of the way I used to look at things. Now, the way I would say is, you know, certainly that's still true, that AI is essentially just a subcategory of design. And so, like, an AI programmer should, like, have a strong game design background. But I'd also say that I think that the idea of making symmetrical games is, to some extent, it's not like it's fundamentally flawed, but I think that a lot of games start with that as a starting point for no good reason. It's just kind of like, you know, when Sid made Civ 1, it was just kind of like maybe he had the board game concept in his mind or whatever, but like, yeah, we're just going to start out with, everyone starts with a settler, everyone, you know, all the players in the game found on the same turn, you know, found the first city on the same turn. You know, that's just the way you make games, right? You know, I think that's making things more challenging. You know, I want to say, like, that thing that makes it more challenging for the AI for no good reason, but that sounds like a cop out, like I'm worried about how well the AI is going to perform. That's not what I'm worried about, right? I'm worried about the user experience at the end of the day. And the truth is that if you spend a lot of time worrying about making sure the AI can play the game the exact same way the human is, you're really just wasting your development time on stuff that doesn't really make that much difference. Like with Old World, you know, it's not like an extreme asymmetrical game, like, you know, I don't know, whatever, Into the Breach or something like that, right? It's you know, they're still sort of playing by the same rules you are, but like, we're not pretending like everyone's starting from the same point, right? Like, when you go up in difficulty levels, one of the things we do is changes how many cities and how many units and how many texts that the other nations start with. So the idea, like the analogy I always give is, you know, like, imagine you're Rome in, you know, 400 BC, right? Like, you just have one city, but there's all of these big empires that are already, you know, surrounding, you know, already filling up the Mediterranean, right? Like, that's sort of the experience you get in Old World when you're playing at one of the, you know, medium to higher difficulty levels. And not only that, but, you know, we're kind of like abandoning the sense that the AI is, you know, kind of like even trying to win the game in the sense of like their point is to make sure that you lose, right? Like, we want the game to be a challenge. I mean, I think Old World is actually a pretty challenging game, but you know, I'm not really interested in, you know, making sure I can get the player to lose as much as possible, or rather to lose in some arcane way, right? Like, I know one thing, the Civ games have had a bunch of different victory conditions over the years, right? And it's generally been seen as a good thing to have, like, oh, okay, you got the cultural victory, and you got your religious victory, and your science victory, and your military victory, or whatever. This is also something I'm kind of rejecting, you know, with Old World. It's also something I think has become essentially a bad idea. You know, it was one of these things I think was like started off as a good idea, but now, you know, I think it's kind of holding things back. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. One is that when you have these super long form games, you know, like, you know, a game of Civ might take 500 years or so. And so, you know, if you have all these different, you know, victory flavors, and, you know, as the game gets essentially harder, what it really pushes people to do is like decide what type of victory they're going to go for from the beginning. And then it's just like, well, they're, you know, if you're going for the science victory, then just every time you have a choice, make the science choice, right? It's not really particularly interesting gameplay. But the other issue is that for some of those victories, it's basically fine, right? Like the space race victory, if somehow you end up with a game where you're neck and neck with an AI getting close to the end of a space race, like it's a fantastic experience, right? Now, that's only happened to me like maybe one out of every 10 games of Civ I've ever played, right? So it's like it's fairly rare, but it's at least it makes sense, and it's like, you know, a solid victory condition. But, you know, there have been Civ games where you've had these like kind of hidden victory conditions, like a religious victory where, you know, I forget what the exact rules are, but, you know, the other side, you know, has some sort of threshold they're trying to get to where, you know, if their religion is in X number of cities or X percent of cities, they suddenly win the game. And you'll see like a lot of people have these experiences where, like, they think they're doing fine, and then suddenly they just get this pop-up telling them, hey, by the way, you just lost because, you know, the Babylonians just made 70% of the world, you know, Muslim or something, right? And, you know, it doesn't have really anything to do with the game that you've been playing. You know, like, you know, obviously you probably should have been paying attention to the victory screen or whatever, but, like, it's just not a good experience. Initially with Old World, I actually completely jettisoned the idea that you could even lose the game. Right. Like, it was what I wanted was more of like, OK, there's going to have these things, these like ambitions or whatever or achievements you're aiming for. And once you reach them, you either like reach them or you run out of time. Right. Like those. But that just somehow didn't quite have enough bite. So that's why we pared down to the system where you can lose by victory points to the AI. But you also have this ambition victory that, you know, you kind of fulfill these gradually more and more difficult ambitions that come through the character system. And once you finish your 10th one, then you've won an ambition victory. That does not apply to the AI at all, right? Like, they don't, you know, they don't have ambition victories, right? Because I think that would be like fundamentally unfun to just, you know, randomly just discover that, you know, Rome over there has won an ambition victory. And it's, you know, something that you probably haven't been paying attention to a lot. So I'm rambling. You asked me about AI and game design, right? So
that was the, yeah. But honestly, you brought up a really good point. I think this is something that a lot of like the 4X fanatics at this level, like have really started to see, in that they long for asymmetric gameplay. And, you know, as you say, like it's no longer fun to have the AI play the same game, because it ends up being something, again, where I could go back and say you could cheese different ways to win, or it just doesn't feel like the AI can keep up at all. But if they're playing a separate game, then it starts to feel a lot more competitive and a lot more engaging.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a bit tougher doing a history based one makes it pretty hard, because it just seems very ingrained, where it's like, okay, there's the Egyptians and there's the Romans and there's the Greeks, and they should be doing their thing. You know, I mean, they're going to be playing a game similar to what Jeremy playing. You know, if you made one that's like sci-fi or fantasy, you know, then you can really be, you know, super asymmetrical, you know, that they're just playing these almost completely different games.
I mean, I'd love to see you, you know, visit that genre at some point, but yeah. So I mean, yeah, let's come back to AI, right? So you've clearly had a great deal of experience writing AI, and I think a lot of people would go back and say that Civilization 3 and Civilization 4 especially have had AIs that kind of stand out. Now, like, what goes into producing an AI that can play the game? I mean, like, what do you think is the biggest hurdle for someone like you who's programming AI to make or feel like the AI is competitive throughout the entire game?
I mean, it kind of depends on the type of game, but like for Civ style games, I'd say the biggest challenge is just having unit, you know, like the issue of like having units deal with a map in an intelligent way, right? It's one of these things that it's just very simple for a human to be like, okay, I got my units. I feel like there's some trouble over here. I don't have to worry about this side of my empire. And, you know, I can adapt to do this later, right? It's something very easy for a human to do, very, very difficult for an AI to do, right? Like it's pretty easy to have an AI figure out, like Offworld, a training company, you know, I wrote the AI for that. I'm not writing the AI for Old World, by the way. It's the project has just been too challenging. So Alex Menzeris, who hopefully will be on at some point, can talk about how he's writing it for Old World. I mean, I kind of laid down the very early building blocks just to kind of get it moving. But like, I haven't been able to do it. It's just been too big of a project. And, but like for, like when I think of like an off-world comparison, in some ways that was actually a fairly easy game to write for the, to write AI for, because you just do a lot of comparisons of like, okay, what's the profit of a steel mill versus the profit of a electronics factory. And you can like estimate like how the price has been changing over time and so on and so forth. So like that's pretty straightforward, but you don't have to ever move units around a map in Offworld, right? You don't have to like group them and whatnot. And getting AI to ever to do that in a way that looks good, it looks solid, which by the way, Alex has done a really good job with in Old World, and has really impressed me, because it's something I don't think I ever really mastered with Civ 3 or Civ 4 is a huge challenge. And then there's also a lot of like metagame issues with AI that people don't really consider. Like, yeah, like a lot of people play Civ games basically building as little military as they can get away with, right? Because they really want to focus on the butter side. So, you know, for the long-term payoff. But, you know, the human knows that if they ever get in a really bad situation, they can just reload a few turns before and take a different path, right? Like that. That's not, like, people know that, like, well, I shouldn't do that, but people do that, and they know they can, right? And beyond that, if the AI followed the same path of, like, you know, it's going to skimp on you as much as it can, the human would know that, and it would just invade them every time, right? Like, if the AI also kind of treated you that way, then people would consider that the AI is, I don't know if they say it was cheating, but it was like, the AI is playing too aggressively. It shouldn't be attacking me. We were friends, you know? And it's like, well, yeah, you guys were friends, but you weren't building any military, so why wouldn't the AI attack you? If you were playing a board game with real humans, you would never question their intentions. But that's not the same thing with AI. So, anyway.
Well, I have to admit, I could ask you questions about game design and AI for probably another 7 hours, and I'd still not be satiated. So I want to come back to you and some of your personal life, because sure. You mentioned earlier about being at Oxford, and from what I understand, Christopher Tin was there at the same time?
Yep. Yep. He, not just that, he was my roommate, my randomly assigned roommate at Oxford.
Oh, wow. So, and I imagine that somehow, like, it's some way, that's how he got involved with Civilization 4 and then ended up making the only Grammy Award winning soundtrack.
Yeah, he was a aspiring composer at the time, and that, like, he was a music student at Stanford, and he knew that that's what he wanted to do. I mean, when you're at that age, you know, you have a sense of like what you hope to do, but you don't know if that's something that could ever actually happen. And I was not yet even necessarily thinking I was going to make video games, like, but like, you know, I was, well, whatever I was. And we became friends. I mean, I loved my experience over there. It was one of those things where you get just immersed and you get to know, you know, you get really close with the people who are there. And, you know, he and I and some other friends, we would take trips to London. We took a trip to Scotland. We went to Wales. You know, we saw music. And I remember taking one trip to a church, I believe, because he had gotten a chamber group there to perform one of his pieces. I'm just remembering that now, which must have been really cool for him. And, you know, we stayed in touch some. after college, but I was pretty heads down on Civ 3 and then starting up Civ 4. So I probably had not seen him much after I graduated. And we bumped into each other at our 5-year reunion at Stanford. And, you know, I was telling him that I was working on Civ 4, and he was really into video games as well. So he was excited by that. And he was telling me about some of his, early work as a composer. I think by then maybe he had done some kind of I forget what there's a term for this, but like he had done some of the for some of the X-Men films. He had written a little bit of music. You have your big names like Hans Zimmer composers, right, who come in and write the big themes or whatever. But like a 2-hour movie just requires a lot of music, right? And so they need lesser known composers to kind of write some of the more filler type music. And he started to do that, which was at that point in our lives, that was really exciting, right? I was like, wow, you're going somewhere. Like, that's really cool, Chris. And I forget whether seeing him made me think of this or I thought of this earlier, but he had been involved with this great a cappella group at Stanford called Talisman, which specialized in basically African music and among others. I mean, and also some great American music as well. But and he produced an album for them, which I guess he must have given me the album, I bet. At maybe when we were in college, and it just sat around in my CD collection. I had a huge CD collection. I'm really into music, so at that point, I kind of topped out at around 2,000 CDs at one point. I know Layla can probably complain to you about this almost like half a ton of CDs that we lugged around for a couple different places. Yeah, as we moved around earlier in our life, and eventually, I've kind of bit the bullet and digitized everything and got rid of it, because at that point it felt more like a chain, like an anchor or a chain around my neck. But like I had actually, this is the people who worked with me at Firaxis during the Civ 4 era, they can probably might remember that I had a pretty crazy music setup in my office, because this would have been 2004, 2005. And I suppose MP3s had taken off around that time. So that's how most people probably were having these giant music collections. But I don't want to come across as like goody two shoes or something, but like I just had never downloaded music on the internet or something. Like I'd done a lot of the BMG Columbia House stuff to get like cheap CDs, right? And like I was pretty, I was always looking for deals or whatever. But so that's how I kind of built. I also reviewed music actually at Stanford for the paper. Like I would review a CD each week. So like I had another good way of getting basically free music. So I had this giant thing of CDs, and I would be, it's just not, looking back, I just can't even imagine how people, you did records, because they're these huge things and they're only one side of a record is 15, 20 minutes, it seems like you'd be constantly getting up to change the record. But, I always wanted music playing. That was just a thing. Like, I love music. I always wanted some music playing. And so, I just got tired of going to my CD collection, grabbing a CD, putting in the right thing, taking it back, picking another one, so on and so forth. And when you have a collection that big, it just becomes cumbersome. Now, what I should have done is just digitize it all, right? But instead, what I did is I bought 3 400-disc CD changers. And they were all stacked up on top of these bookshelves, and I had them plugged into my stereo system. So I would just have it shuffle, from one to the other. And keep in mind, these were these big things. They're maybe 2 feet by 2 feet wide, and then maybe another foot tall. And you would there's a little gate that would open. It was imagine a carousel. Right, like the circular carousel where you'd stick in the CDs sideways and you put 400 CDs into each one of these boxes, right? And it would turn around to play it. And the whole process of just putting the CDs in took forever. And I organized it all, right? So I would have I split, you have your classical section, and of course you do the classical historically, right? You won't just put it in randomly. That's terrible, right? And then you have your jazz section and your blues or whatever, and your rock section. And, I generally split that up into pre-Velvet Underground rock and post-Velvet Underground rock, because that's kind of that's one, how it sort of makes sense most logically. And, then you kind of maybe split it up by parts of the country and whatever. So at any rate, I get everything set up. And at that point I had maybe 800 CDs in there, right? Because maybe not all the CDs made the cut to be inside these things, because they were maybe $300 a piece. So I could like be like, okay, if I want to listen to just jazz today, I'll just start in the CD and I'll just start moving forward, right? Or maybe I'll do a random shuffle. But then, of course, I kept buying new CDs. And at that point, I was like, well, now I need a new one. And now, like, it's just total chaos because I'm not going to reorder my entire CD collection every time I get one, right? So sometimes I would, like, leave some space. So, like, okay, I know I'm going to buy some more Beethoven, so I better leave some space here. But, of course, eventually, when you're dealing with physical objects, like any sort of, like, numbering system is just, or, you know, order system is just going to fall apart, right? And, you know, obviously I became aware that, like, this was not the future. At some point, this was not sustainable. So I, you know, digitized everything. And then, you know, we did a move. And, you know, it's amazing how much a moving box full of CDs weighs. It's crazy. Like, you know, I don't know. It's somehow they're heavier because they're just all packed together. So anyway, I got rid of it all. And, you know, everything now was just, I was like, now everything's in my phone. It's amazing. Wow. How did I even start the story?
How do you get to the point where Christopher Tin comes to you and is like, hey, I've got this thing, this song that I think right. your okay. intro song.
So he had given me probably the CD called After Silence, which was the Talisman album that he had produced for them when he was in college. And it had this, the last track on the album, this track called The Rainmaker, which was a Hans Zimmer piece from The Power of One, a movie called The Power of One, which is South, I believe is a film about South Africa. I've never actually seen it. I probably should watch it. Anyway, it's this amazing piece of, you know, kind of like African choral music. And oftentimes when making a game, it's nice in the early days just to throw in a piece of music into the title screen that just kind of like gives a feel to it, right? Just gives it a certain atmosphere, right? It's something that's music can just deliver that so much better than almost anything else, especially when the visuals of the game are bad, right? But you can pick a fully formed piece of music that you know you're not going to be able to ship with, but it's just there to help people understand what you're trying to accomplish. And so I just threw The Rainmaker in there, and somehow it just kind of worked. Like it sounded, you know, sounded really good. Everyone really liked it. And so I was like, okay, great. So I went to, I think what I was talking to, I wanted to talk to Chris about when I saw him was, I was like, can we use Talisman's version of The Rainmaker? You know, and he was like, yeah, that sounds fantastic, right? And so then the issue is we had to clear the publishing rights from Hans Zimmer. And I believe what he said was that he was not willing to license his music for a video game because of violence, basically. And, you know, okay. I'm pretty sure his music has been in video games since then, but whatever. That's fortunate because that meant that I was like, okay, well, now the logical thing to do instead is see if I can ask Chris to write a piece of music that basically would replace what I had wanted to put in there, right? And as you know, I suggested that to Chris, and you know, he thought that sounded great. And you know, we got a contract together, and it was very much just a side thing because, you know, generally speaking, if you hire a composer to write stuff for a game, it's going to be like an hour of music or something. It's going to be a very involved thing. But in this case, we just signed him up to do two pieces, one for like the intro movie that plays, you know, before the game starts, and the other for the title screen for Bobby Yetu and what became Bobby Yetu. And, you know, he put the piece together, and yeah, it was just one of those things where it just sort of magically everything, you know, sort of came together. You know, we had some back and forth on it, and, you know, we could tell it was really becoming something special. But even of course, even when the game came out, that we had no idea it would have this kind of afterlife where, you know, like it's just taking on a life of itself. It's a choir. It's a staple among choirs. The sheet music is like super popular. It's just a wonderful piece. So he won a Grammy, obviously. not something that we had like aimed to accomplish with Civ 4. That wasn't on our list of like, maybe we might win a Grammy, you know. That was just sort of a side thing. Or I don't even know what word to use for it, but it was amazing. Yeah, like we were really thrilled, you know, like Chris and I still just kind of pinch ourselves when we see each other over the whole process.
And I assume that means you still keep in touch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Chris did the soundtrack for Off-World Train Company, which, by the way, is, I think, one of the best things he's ever done because the music was built to match the game, right? It's not just a bunch of random tracks. You know, it's like a set of pieces which are tied to how you progress in the game, you know, what level of HQ you are, So it has a bunch of loops that kind of like fit together in certain ways, and the tension sort of slowly builds, and the pieces work well on their own, but like in the game itself, like it flows seamless together and it matches how you're playing, and like I think it's fantastic.
So I know this is a question that's been asked a lot, and I'm not sure if you're able to answer it yet, but will Christopher Tin be featured in Old World?
I guess since we haven't announced specifically yet.
Okay. All right. So I'll leave it as that teaser. First of all, yeah, congratulations. I mean, like, it's many years after the fact, but like, that's just such a cool story to hear that you guys were roommates and then you end up kind of teaming up together to make this an amazing intro song that, I mean, yeah, like you were saying, the choirs are singing, and, you know, I think it was on, like America's Got Talent even. I mean, there's been so many times. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, there was this huge choir that sang it for, I think that's the one. That or The X Factor. I mix up those shows sometimes, but yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, that's so cool. So then moving forward, how do you go from Firaxis and Civilization 4 to founding Mohawk?
Well, kind of took a detour after Firaxis through Electronic Arts and then a year at Zynga, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that at all.
This the secret history. You know, I joined EA to work on Spore, which was an interesting project. It was a very ambitious project, and I maybe should have known better beforehand that, like, if something sounds too good to be true, it's possibly that it is. And it actually had, Spore had some pretty amazing things about it. It's actually a game that's actually still played quite a bit. It's actually had a pretty long afterlife because the editors are amazing. But kind of the whole concept of all these different levels of the game fitting together was a little bit too ambitious and maybe didn't fit together. It was just almost impossible to make everything fit together. This concept of going from a cell to a creature to a civilization to the whole, you know, the entire universe. You know, there's a lot of ideas that sound great to pitch, but are a lot harder to actually design. And, you know, it's funny looking in retrospect now that, you know, Layla is a part of Mohawk, but like the answer was right in front of me at the time, because Layla was I met Layla after I did Civ 4, but she really enjoyed Civ 4. She's a huge fan of Offworld. Like she's probably the person at Mohawk who's the biggest booster of Offworld. But, you know, shortly after I joined EA, I had Layla give it a try, and she was pretty much like, what is this? Like, do not like, and you know, so she has a good critical eye.
Well, that begs me the question, because you brought her up, how did you guys meet?
So we met online. Basically, Civ 4 finished. I really kind of like looked up from the 3 years that disappeared of my life into that project, and, you know, wanted to, you know, get a social life, get a life. Basically, I worked really hard on that project, and I, you know, I wanted to change things. And so, but, you know, I was a single guy living in a part of the country where I didn't really have family or hadn't really had a lot of connections outside of just work. And so I tried online dating and put up a profile on Match.com. I mean, I know that like things like Tinder are sort of the standard things right now, but that was, I assume Match.com is still around, but it was probably the biggest site for that type of thing back then. And this would have been 2006. And I was looking, and Layla had a profile up there, and she reached out to me one night when I was up late, I don't know, doing something. I think I was preparing a talk or something. And, you know, she messaged me just basically like literally just, are you online? So there must have been something about my profile that caught her eye. Yeah, I think she was studying for an exam, and she was like maybe procrastinating looking for people to chat with. And I had met a total of one person through Match.com. So I was a pretty unsuccessful, like whatever they're called, user of the product. And so, you know, I saw Layla's profile and I was really interested in her. And so I responded and, you know, we were able to arrange a time to meet. And one of the stories we like to tell is she kind of didn't realize that, I think she thought I was the wrong, she thought I was someone else on the site.
You catfished her.
Well, she, I mean, she's a beautiful woman, right? And so she had no shortage of guys that she could talk with on Match.com. I maybe not in the same boat as her, in terms of, you know, how many people are interested in me. So, you know, like, she presumably was talking with a number of people, and she didn't notice that I lived way up in Baltimore and she was living in DC. She was working for the State Department and teaching languages and things like that. So once we got to talk more, she realized, oh, you're not so-and-so. You're, where do you live? And what do you do? And I was like, oh, well, I make video games and I live not just in Baltimore. I live way north of Baltimore. But, you know, I convinced her to, you know, have a first date and went down there, and it just, you know, we had sushi and it, you know, it, we just hit it off. Like I think we saw each other every day for 3 weeks straight, even though I lived like an hour and a half away. At Firaxis, it hit the rumor mill pretty quickly because, you know, I went from someone who was there, you know, every day to suddenly it was like I completely disappeared. So they knew that something pretty big was up. And Layla's Lebanese, and we took a trip out to Lebanon. So this was in February or March, you know, that we started a date. And, you know, I met her family pretty quickly. And then we took a trip out to Lebanon to meet a lot of our extended family there. And this was actually, this was such a crazy year. You may not remember, but Israel had attacked Lebanon that year. I had flown back and she was going to stay with her family to see them longer because, of course, she can only go to Lebanon so often. While she was there by herself, Israel decided to attack Lebanon and there was like a month-long war and she was trapped there. And, of course, we didn't know how long the war was going to be. So, you know, I spent... you know, that whole month kind of frantically trying to get a hold of all sorts of different people in the government to see if we could get her out of there. And eventually she was airlifted out to maybe I'm stealing her story from her podcast, but but she was airlifted out to an aircraft carrier and eventually flown to Cyprus. And, you know, I picked her up from an Air Force base in New Jersey that summer, you know, we'd been separated for a month while she had been trapped over there. It was just an amazing time. And we got married that October. So we got married the same year we met. And she had not really thought much about video games, I believe, until, you know, we met. You know, I kind of introduced her to them and she, you know, she really got into them. I really had not did for Offworld. I just definitely did not necessarily expect that would become her favorite game. But, you know, she got really into it. And, you know, like, you know, opportunity came up where she could kind of, you know, move from the State Department to Mohawk if she wanted. And, you know, she took it and, you know, we, you know, we're really glad she's a part of the company. It's been really great to, like, because for me, like, making video games, it's not a normal job. You know, it's like a lifelong passion. Right. And so, I try to do my best to kind of like, you know, keep a healthy personal life and professional life. But the reality is that it just always kind of like sloshes together. So, you know, having Layla be passionate about the project that I'm passionate about is really like a dream come true. So I'm very, very happy that she's on board.
Yeah. It feels like you guys complement each other really well, really, like, right. Cause you're the designer and the AI kind of like with all due respect, the computer geek here. Right. And she's like this very organized, very capable person of like kind of leading things, right? And so it feels like you've let her start leading some of the more administrative aspects of Mohawk while you kind of focus on what you do best, right?
Yeah, well, and also a lot of the personal aspects. She's just very good with people, right? Like, it's not, you know, I try my best, but it's probably not my number one talent. So So, you know, it's good because you need a leader, and that's, you know, I certainly provide design leadership, but that's not, you know, like friend, just general leadership to the company and employees to let them know where we're going and, you know, like why they're, and just, you know, deal with the problems and to inspire them is something that she's very good at. And, you know, she's gotten involved. She's also, I mean, she loves history and she, you know, she's also was, she originally, her first plan was just, she wanted to do some writing. You know, she just kind of like volunteered to help out on the writing side because we were going to need a lot of writers. Now we have like, I don't even know, 5 or 6 writers who are people who are kind of like writing events at different levels, right? You know, we knew need a lot of that. And so, you know, she volunteered for that early on. So that's another thing that, you know, it was cool to see her get involved with. And I think the thing that maybe surprised her is that how how much she's enjoyed getting involved on the art side of things. She's basically in charge of the, you know, like all of the, like the event art and the 2D art and that you see in the game, she's been providing the direction for. You know, that's been really, you know, I think she's really enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, I can see that too. Cause I mean, she's very disarming, right? Like she's very personable. And, you know, I think that, yeah, I can imagine that, you know, with you on one side of it, kind of leading the development side, and with her being the kind of like the face of the company in some ways, that really seems to be working out really well. And I really like that for you guys that, you know, it's not often that you can find a marriage that works and actually can be working together. I mean, sometimes people want nothing but to not work together. So it's cool that you guys do that and found that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you put it right that, you know, we complement each other really well. Like our strengths are in different areas. So, you know, it's usually pretty clear. I think the one place, interestingly enough, that we kind of, we're inevitably both going to be the most involved when will probably be the music. And that's something we're still working through. We're dealing with a lot of like licensing issues and, you know, choosing soundtracks and talking about what things we could do, what type of music we can have. But like, that's something that I think that's one area that we're both personally very passionate about. And you know, we're enjoying working together, but yeah, I think for a lot of other things, it's, we each have our own specific areas that we have expertise. Yeah. So we've got three kids and one cat. He's like almost like half a kid. He's that big of a part of our family. And we, our oldest 12-year-old boy, he's in the sixth grade, and Sebastian, and he's, you know, he's really bright. He's super into video games right now. And, you know, we're doing for people who listen to this years in the future, we're right in the middle of a pandemic right now. You know, so they haven't been in school for 9 months, and it's pretty intense. But, you know, it's video games are nice because this is something that he's been able to, you know, when he has time to play games, he's able to get together with four or five of his friends online, and, you know, they play Fortnite or they play Minecraft or they play whatever. But, you know, it's actually gives them a chance to play something and connect. You know, if this had happened when I was a kid, we would have all been just completely disconnected from each other. Right. So that's something really nice to see. I should mention also that he was the first person to stream Old World, I suppose. Is that right? Yeah. We had our embargo lift for streamers, and we made sure that he was available to be like the very first person to stream it. You know, he's like probably almost every kid like is really into YouTubers, right? And so that was something he aspired to do. So we gave him a chance to be like the first person to be streaming off world. And I forget if he played as Baby Lawn, but that's how he pronounced it. It was adorable. And so he has a YouTube video. He has a YouTube channel, and, you know, he posts his stuff, and, you know, at any rate. And then we have twins, boy girl twins, who are, my brain's supposed to have about nine. and they're Connor and Catherine, and they're adorable. They're so close. They're very different in personality, but they're just attached to the hip. They love each other so much. They'll just do everything they can together, and they're great. And then we have our cat Oliver, who is the most personable cat you'd ever known, will ever know. He's basically like a dog. The kids just have like always, since he was a kitten, he like his feet almost never touch the ground. They were always carrying him around. So he will sleep like right on top of Sebastian's face. You know, he's a very, very good cat. So that's, you know, that's our life. We are looking forward to them going back to school, of course, but, you know, I'm sure that many years from now, we'll look back at this whole pandemic thing as like this intense bonding thing for our family. Last January, I don't even know if I could describe to myself back then, like what we were about to all go through. You know,
I mean, I think it's something, I mean, clearly it's once in a lifetime thing, right? And it's changed so much about the way we're going to be doing everything moving forward that it's just, mm-hmm. you know, it's hard to even wrap our heads around as we're going through it. And yeah, I'm hoping that we can get to some sort of normalcy within the next year, because I'm eager for it too.
Yeah, I mean, life for us is going to change radically, because obviously we're working really hard trying to finish up Old World, and the kids are all home. But, you know, I'm basically assuming, right, like in next September, that school, you know, people will be vaccinated, the kids will be back in school, we'll be done with Old World. Like it'll be quite a different experience.
And speaking of that, so your path to being done with Old World, what does that look like?
Well, we've said that we're going to be releasing it this year, and, you know, we will let people know when we know the exact date. But, you know, I think we're really happy with it. We get a lot of reports that people feel like it's like, are you finished game? You know, we had a really fun thing come through our company Slack today where we have an in-game bug reporter where you can report, you know, random bugs you do. And apparently some guy reported a bug where all he said was like, there's no bug. I just want to let you guys know, like, I'm having so much fun playing the game. So our programmer, Mustafa, who usually sees these, had to let us know about it. I had never seen that before through a bug reporter. So nice.
Yeah, I mean, having played it since you guys came, I mean, like, even before Early Access, you guys brought me on early, and it was a lot of fun to get to know the process and see it from the ground up. And I will say that my last few games, I haven't seen anything that's really stuck out that really feels like needs to be squashed or needs to be fixed. So you guys are definitely on the right path.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing is right now is just, we really want the characters and events to matter. And I think there was still some apprehension on that for a while. And I always believe that, like, what we just need is a lot of them. You know, we just need a lot of events. So you're seeing different ones that combine in different ways, but the system is built to be like really flexible. And it's the type of thing that I think will get sort of exponentially better as we add more and more stuff.
With that, you know, you have a release date sometime in 2021. And I imagine beyond that, there's plans for more. But, you know, what kind of things lay before you?
I mean, we're a company that cares about strategy games, and we may make games that are not officially strategy games, but they're always going to be strategic games, right? Like, I think we're going to kind of stick to that. And, you know, probably I'd like to work on something that maybe doesn't take 5 years, like Old World will have. There's a lot of, you know, we have some ideas of what we want to know, of what we want to do. But I think the kind of the big thing, we'd like to actually be able to work on two projects at the same time. You know, like, I basically, that'll be a big, you know, a big step forward for the studio. You know, we basically just went from Off World to Old World. And with Old World, we want, and I think there's a very good chance that happen, we want Old World to be a big enough success that we can keep working on it for, you know, 3 or 4 years, right? Like, that there should be a lot of more things you can do with the system, right? You can go to different places around the world. You can add more depth. You can go to different, slightly different time period. Yeah, there's just, you can have scenarios. We can start having little battle maps, you know, and whatever. I mean, there's just so much stuff you can do with the Old World engine that, you know, we want to be able to keep developing on it. But at the same time, we also want to be able to, like, make something also completely different. So that's the next big step for Mohawk.
That's exciting stuff. I'm really excited to hear that, and I'm really excited to see what you guys bring up and make going forward. So, Soren, where can we find you? If we wanted to come find you and pester you on any social medias or anything like that, where can we find you?
Generally, Twitter is the place I'm most active, which is not necessarily a ton, but active enough. And that's just, I got lucky, and then my Twitter handle is just Soren Johnson. So very easy to find me.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Soren. It's been really great to get to know you and a little bit more about your story and your romance with Layla. I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your day.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Rob.